welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and on today's episode, we're talking about the U.S. U-20s being great, as well as the many Americans on the move, or potentially on the move. To do so, I'm joined by our longtime friend from American Soccer Now. It's Brian Sciarretta. Brian, welcome back. Great to speak to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Taylor. It's always thrilled to be on.
Yeah, man. How are you enjoying your summer without soccer, in which there's been an awful lot of soccer happening?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, I've had a tough time catching up. It was tough covering the game last week with my computer meltdown while I was on vacation, and I was typing a lot with my thumb on my iPhone. But other than that, you know, it's been a lot of fun. And now it's we got MLS in full swing, preseason beginning, and you know, it's really there's no real national team stuff to cover for a bit, so it's really now on the clubs,
yeah.
and players progressing there, and then just overall the fun of club soccer, you know, with weak competition, you know, on a near weekly basis.
Yeah, man. Well, we're going to talk about some club soccer moves in a moment. First, let's talk U-20s. As you said, you were covering them. The U.S. 20s won their third straight CONCACAF U-20 championship, which has added weight this time around. Can you explain what their finish means in terms of qualifying for future competitions?
Oh, it was huge because for the first time they've wrapped up Olympic qualification into the U-20 age group as opposed to the U-23. And the U-23 was always a tough age group because players were never getting released. You know, when you're that age, you're not really a youth player anymore, but they tried to treat it like, you know, you were and clubs, you know, chance to get like a 22, 23 year old voluntarily released from club detail means he has to be like a B teamer, a bench player. And it was proving to be very impossible. So they really did the right thing in making this U-20 eligible because it's the oldest you can get really towards having your A players released, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they did that, and U.S. was able to field a strong squad. Not everyone was released, but a pretty strong squad. And, you know, it was a fair and square reflection, I think, of where we are. And I think it reflected, you know, well. And then they qualified for the Olympics and the U-20 World Cup. So the Olympic curse is now over. Now, what's fun about that now is that the Olympics is for an older age group. So players who were born in 2001 and 2002 – are now going to be able to be part of the U-23 team, even if they didn't have any qualification. Now, I think when the Olympics roll around, you're not going to be able to get everyone released, but because the full national team is not going to be in, we don't know what their schedule is going to be like, but there won't be World Cup qualification. I think there's going to be an importance on the Olympics. And I think they'll get a lot of their top players released. You know, you could be talking about a Musso or a Reyna. So anyway, it opens up the door now to the 01 to 2001 and 2002 born players who had their U-20 cycle canceled because of COVID. And now they're going to be Olympic eligible. And now you can run up that team. You can open up that team knowing qualifications already secure. Let's build a team for the Olympics.
Man. So we have a team we could potentially build for the Olympics. I'm excited to talk about some names that could be added to that. First, with the games that we've now had in the U-20 championships, if you, Brian, were building your kind of preferred starting 11 for this team, if they're playing one more game that they've got to win with the players they had here, what does that lineup look like for you?
I mean, it's pretty close to, yeah, I mean, without the squad rotation, mm-hmm. I think, and look, there's going to be some players who weren't released who would fit in the mold, but I'm pretty even on the goalkeepers between Brady and Carrera. I know Chris Brady was the number one. I don't see that much separating those two. So that's a push, but I think Cuevas on the right and Noah Allen on the left. And I thought Jalen Neal and Brandon Craig were the best starting central defenders. That defensive midfielder is a push because both Rokas Puskas and Daniel Edmund, both of them impressed me quite a bit. You know, I think, you know, you can't go wrong either way. You know, maybe Edelman, cause he was seen as captain like material. And then I think, you know, in the other midfield positions, you want Paxton and Jack McGlynn. And then up top, Cade Cowell, who's now suspended for the first game of the U-20 World Cup, cause that suspension will carry over. And, Quinn Sullivan. And then, you know, kind of that false nine role, you know, I guess you'd have to go with Caden Clark. You know, that's not his best position, but they don't really have a number nine in his age group. So they've been trying to make do without that.
When was the last time we had a number nine? It was Jozy Altidore, right? Like, does any age group have, like, that out-and-out number nine that maybe fans would love to
see?
Well,
I thought Pepe would have been really good in this tournament, too. I mean, if you would put him now down with the U-20s, which he was eligible for this tournament. He was one of the players who was eligible and, you know, was not either released or they were giving him time off. You know, he would have been good. But, yeah, you know, it's been a tough position to fill. They wanted the Malik Sanogo kid from Union Berlin at the start of the cycle. But they brought him into a couple of camps, and it just didn't work out for him. There was high expectations there. So, you know, unfortunately with that, they have to kind of – and then remember Patrick Wea, the kid from Minnesota United, tore his ACL. They wanted to give him looks. So it never really worked out. They're still kind of, you know, Josh Sargent was a very good at the youth level, but in terms of a youth guy who then makes the transition to the full team, I don't know. And look, I think it's also a tough position, because I think you start seeing these guys get really, really good in their later 20s too. It might be one of these situations where guys are really good at the youth level, then they take their lumps for a number of years when they make the transition from youth to senior. And then eventually, you know, in the later senior, then they start getting good again in their later 20s, mid-later 20s. That's not going to surprise me if that starts being the case for a number of these guys, like, you know, Josh Sargent, for example. You know, I still think, you know, people want to write them off so early. But I think the striker position, we're going to go through like a realization curve, at least the fans will, in terms of realizing that this is a position kind of like goalkeeper more than anything, where it goes away and then it comes back. Jeremy Obobese is a great example. He's one of the best scorers in MLS right now. And, you know, he struggled a little bit in his transition from the youth to senior level. And now he's mid 20s, 24, 25, and he's starting to come out of it. So we'll see. But I think that's going to be the natural progression of things.
And you've watched many, many different U.S. youth teams perform at many, many different competitions. In this one, the U.S. drops points to Canada in their 2-2 draw in the group stage. That aside, I believe they won their other two group stage games. They won all of their knockout round games without conceding a goal. That Canada game aside, they were 6-0, 29 goals scored, 0 conceded. With some of those numbers in mind, how strong of a team do you feel like this is in comparison to previous teams we've seen? Because to me, it feels like a very, very strong one that then, as you've already said, was missing some key contributors, so it could be even stronger potentially.
Right. Look, I think going on a 20-0 goal-scoring advantage after that second Canadian goal was something. You know, they didn't concede to Honduras in Honduras. You know, so look, some things went well for them. It broke their way some ways. But yeah, look, my concerns are still the same with this team. It's like when look at like the last couple of TAB teams that he had. The central defenders that they had on those teams were very, very good. Mm-hmm. Like in 15, you had Matt Miazga, Cameron Carter-Vickers, Eric Palmer-Brown, and then, you know, then two of those guys continued on to the next cycle. And you had guys like Chris Richards, Mark McKenzie, and even Justin Glad, who might not be a national team player, but for a U-20 level, he was great. Mm-hmm. So it's like you had always good central defenders, and you could build the team outward. It's very tough to build a youth team without good central defense. It covers up for a lot of mistakes out there. So to kind of be good without good central defense, and not that this central defense in this group is poor, but it's just they really lack the experiences of other U-20 cycles in the past. So it's tough to build that kind of a team. The rest of the team is very, very good. They got a great midfield. They have guys who can really possess the ball and create. But again, you know, like also without a number nine, too. I mean, you know, Josh Sargent was good. Rubio Rubin was good. I mean, these are even Sebastian Soto was good at the youth level. He never made the transition to the senior level or even the pro level yet. That's been an unfortunate situation. But like, you know, but in terms of how these teams actually perform, you know, they're covering up for their weakness as well. They're adjusting for their weakness as well. You know, they're getting, when their central defense is kind of a question mark, they're getting great performances out of their defensive midfield. So I like how well they're coached. I like how they're addressing their weaknesses. But, you know, look, it's going to be interesting to see over time how Mike Ivaris, who I think is a very good coach, is going to continue to adjust this team and tinker with this team to address those weaknesses well, because, you know, it's those are tough weaknesses to overcome. And look, so far, it looks like they are doing it, too.
Based on the way this team played, how much should U.S. fans be thanking the Philadelphia Union organization, do you think?
Unbelievable. Well, here's the thing. They have the biggest footprint on the U-20 team and the U-17 team coming up as well. I mean, they're going to put their footprint on, like, a big portion of the youth national teams, too. And they just keep coming. Like, you know, I think, I mean, they had 15 goals in this tournament. You know, that's and something like 6 assists, if I'm not wrong. I know I got 15 goals right, but I think it was 6 assists as well. That's a ton of production from four guys, and one of them being a central defender who's not supposed to really contribute much into the offense. But, you know, they are they get it done, and it's a big credit to Jim Curtin. Now, the big test for him is maybe not with the U-17s, because they're not really knocking on the door at the first team yet. But these U-20 kids, they're going to have to really kind of complete the cycle and get them involved with the first team more than they have been. And I think there is a plan for that. I think there was always what could get through this tournament before they started introducing them, because you didn't want to introduce them in May or April, then lose them for a month, yeah, and then bring them back into I think that to keep a continuous flow, this tournament has always been marked on their calendar saying, you know, this is when we're going to get Paxton in some minutes or Jack or Quinn. You know, I think it's, but yeah, Philadelphia Union is now having a tremendous, tremendous impact on the youth national teams, all for the better.
Who are there U-17 eligible players that you're more excited about?
Oh, well, they just won the MLS Next, right? You know, at the U-17 division. And
I will take your word for that. I should probably follow that more closely.
Yeah, you know, and I tend not to get too involved with specific names and getting excited about U-7, at least at the beginning of cycles, U-17 cycles, and talking about individual performers, because it's really about an overall class of kids, because you never know which one are going to perform, you know, at this early in cycle. You're talking about, you know, 15, sometimes 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. You don't really have that good of an idea as to who's there yet, and it'd be kind of unfair, but they're there in numbers, and then it becomes a numbers game. You know, you have 30, 40 good players, you know, a certain number of them are going to stick.
Who from this U-20 team, I think, like, Qatar 2022 feels maybe a bit too soon for anybody on this squad to be in consideration. You never know, but it seems very unlikely. But who, either in the near future, maybe after 2022 or just down the road, who are you most confident will end up representing the U.S. men's national team at some point? Who has that ability either in the next year or two or maybe 5 years down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think Paxton Aaronson, mm-hmm, is knocking at the door pretty closely. You know, I think, you know, I think the minutes will be there for him probably sooner than everybody else. He was the best player in the tournament by a long way for any team, you know. And then also I'm keeping an eye, you know, it comes down also to playing time too, you know, and who's on a path to first team minutes, because if the path isn't there for first team minutes, it's not going to be there with the national team. You know, I think there is a big need for the national team too to develop another number six beyond Tyler and Kellen Acosta. They need more numbers there. So, you know, I really like Daniel Edelman, but, like, when you look at the Red Bulls, like, is he going to take over Frankie Amaya or Christian Caceres' job anytime soon? I don't necessarily see that. I think they'll try to work him in greatly, but quickly and here and there. But, you know, you need to be like a consistent starter. So I would bet still on the Union kids. You know, Quinn Sullivan looks good. I think, you know, they'll start working him into more minutes in Philadelphia too. And you're talking about under seven, you know, other Philadelphia Union kids. His brother, who's only like 12 or 13, looks like an unbelievable player at that age group. You know, so, you know, Diego Luna is another one too, who just moved to Real Salt Lake. You know, I think, you know, I think there's going to be a real plan for him there, because they really went out of their way to bring him into the organization, and they spent some real money to do that. And they're not going to spend that kind of money unless there's a plan. And I think at RSL, it's not like LAFC. There's not going to be, huge priced guys or very prestigious guys there blocking you. And Alejandro Alvarado too had a very good tournament. You know, he's at Vizela in Portugal, only played in about four games last year. But, you know, if that steady production increases too, you know, he could be looking at like one of those number eight positions too. I don't see any, you're right though. I don't see any, a lot of these guys really being in the mix before the World Cup. But really, I mean, the next cycle starts in probably like 4 months or 5 months. It's going to be probably like another January camp. So it's not that far off. And it's July. So, you know, I think, you know, they got to be starting to think about the next cycle. And you know, and with these guys, and I think that there's a real future there, but I do think that a lot of these guys will be focused in next year early at the U20 World Cup. And then it's always usually after the U20 World Cup, you look at these guys and you say, okay, what do we have? And that's still a year away.
Is there any connection, an American connection to Vizela? Because that's where Alex Mendez is, right?
Oh, Vizela. Yeah. I mean, they're all the same agent. You know, there's an agent connection there. You know, there a lot of times that's how certain things work. But yeah, that is how it is. I mean, you know, those clubs in those lower parts of Portugal tend not to pay that well. So, you know, it's one of these things where you want to make a name for yourself there and then kind of move on to, you know, a more higher paying gig. So we'll see how it goes. It is a smaller team in Portugal, but, you know, it's not a bad place for a young player to be.
And one more name I wanted to discuss a little bit or pick your brain on a little bit would be Rokas Pustas. Yep. Apologies for my butchering of that one. Currently with Hajduk Split, but is an American playing over there, only 17 years old. What would you say are his strengths that he's bringing to this team? What are the things he needs to work on if he wants to make that next jump?
Well, you know, for him, I did a split piece on him for soccer, for ASN. I'm going to be doing a piece this week on him for Soccer America, so I'm happy that you brought him up. You know, look, I think with him, you know, he's got a lot of ability. He's a really competitive kid. I think, you know, in terms of what he needs to work on, I think it's really just getting settled into a position, because he was really in almost an advanced attacking midfielder at the start of this U20 cycle. They realized he had some skill set to play that number six defensive midfield position. When I spoke to him, he really liked that position. Like he told me he was like the fireman. He likes to put out fires defensively, but that's not necessarily in his background. He's still getting adjusted to that. So it's more or less for him, if he really wants that position, he's got to spend more time there and learning it. I mean, he's less than a year into that position. You know, that's it. But I think this, you know, he's got a really good future. He's got a really good, you know, technical base. He's got a good physical base. Shouldn't surprise me that he's a good athlete. You know, his dad represented Lithuania at the 2004 Olympics. He was a marathon runner. So, you know, there's a lot of, athleticism in his family. And I know Rokas wants to now be this, another Olympian, and represent the United States in soccer. So, but yeah, I like him, but now it's all about showing more progress now in Croatia with Hajduk Split and getting more minutes and going from the transition from the youth to the senior team at a club level. That's always the toughest thing, because some kids can get their foot in the door, but it's then going into becoming consistent minutes, not just, you know, occasional cameos and stuff. That's a big, big, tough hurdle to make. And we'll see how he can do it starting in the season.
I have a few more questions for Brian Schroeder. Sure. About the U20s. First, we're going to take one quick break to hear from today's sponsors. Then we'll be back with more U20s. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. Welcome back, Brian. My major question that I still have about the U-20s relates to the brawl against Costa Rica. A lot of kind of coverage on that one. Twitter had many, many different thoughts on it, many of them relating to, like, when in CONCACAF. For you, what was your reaction to that brawl, and particularly to the reaction to that brawl? How have you felt about the kind of discipline that's been handed out and the reaction from CONCACAF to the violence on the pitch?
It was unfortunate, you know. I think, look, they got Costa Rica got a lot of players suspended, but who knows if it's going to ever really amount to anything, because the rules are that, like, when the end of if they have to be enforced within this age group, then it can move up an age group, but there's no really U-23s anymore because this was the U-23 qualifying. So they didn't qualify for the Olympics. So, you know, these suspensions are now only going to really apply to the national team level for Costa Rica in meaningful competitions. And are any of these guys going to be on the Ticos, first team, senior national team anymore? Who knows? But for Cade Cowell, it was everything. I mean, the U.S. luckily was able to get two of his three games served in the remainder of the tournament. If they didn't play the final, they lost to Honduras, then he would have been suspended for the first two games of the U-20 World Cup. So now he's only missing the first game. But still, despite the numbers, the U.S. Technically had with one of their leading wingers, had to serve the biggest suspension for it. I don't think CONCACAF took that into contention. Now, I'm not saying Cade was completely blameless. Look, I mean, he was maybe still acting in self-defense or defense of a teammate. The brawl was clearly instigated by Costa Rica. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate. I think you would want to see teams get fined potentially more, and then maybe more team suspensions as they relate into future tournaments, or put them on probation, make sure they can't host games. You know, the punishments were very minuscule, even though they listed very long. And, you know, and I know they said they were fined an undisclosed amount too. I wish they'd be a little more transparent with that. But like, yeah, I think that the Costa Rica wasn't punished nearly enough, because I think suspending some players for games that they may never even play in or may not even ever have a part in was just a symbolic gesture of nothingness.
If Cade Cowell does progress the way we would expect him to, I guess maybe this is a bad take, but like the silver lining for it for me is I kind of like when there are those personal rivalries within CONCACAF, within national teams, then I do expect that if he's playing for the senior team against Costa Rica someday, maybe some of that like residual anger will still be there. And maybe that elevates his performance. Maybe it just leads to some trash talking. But I'm assuming some negative relationships have been formed at this point.
Well, that's what makes the U.S.-Mexico thing so much fun, is like, A, it's a border. A, you know, there's historic, because Mexico is used historically so much better than the U.S., it was always the measuring stick, and then the U.S. kind of caught up to him. But Mexico was always the measuring stick towards how well we're how well the United States is progressing. So, and then you mix in the bad blood. You know, the list of incidents with U.S. and Mexico is too long to even go for in a show. I mean, you can have a top 20 countdown and still not even hit all the good ones. But it's actually disappointing in a way, because Costa Rica, they've always been a classy opponent. Mm-hmm. Like, this was, I can't recall a real negative instance with Costa Rica that was serious. I mean, like, I know their fans were very tough at their old stadium for World Cup qualifiers, when they would shake the locker, they'd jump up and down on the locker room and shake it, and you couldn't even get to hear teams in the locker room. You know, but that's just that's not unacceptable gamesmanship compared with what we saw in this tournament. That was really unfortunate, because it was like, it was just unprovoked. I mean, the U.S. team was going out to celebrate, you know, and then I know there might have been some gestures at the fans, but like, Costa Rica really just kind of like swarmed the U.S. team on the field. And that's just, you know, that is completely unacceptable. So, yeah, you hope it makes it for a fun, enticing rivalry. But I mean, geez, these are still kids, and you don't really want to see like everything kind of, you know, degrade from there. Yeah. You know, you want to see some kind of sportsmanship at this level.
Well, let's talk about a happier thing. Let's talk about the Olympics. We've had a few questions about what that squad will look like, including what overage players will be included. I'm not sure we need to go that far with it, but I would who are the players that you would, the age eligible players that you would most like to see added, either because you think they're just very good or you think they would fit this team or areas of need particularly well?
Well, you know, I think what I want to look for is those players who, not like I do think Reyna and Musa will, at least there will be an effort to have them involved because they're age eligible. You know, but like, not including them, because those, we know, you know what those players are. I'm looking at really the players that I think will be kind of cool to look at as a transition into the national team, or maybe those guys who've been a little bit a part of the national team, but could really use the tournament to become a bigger part of the national team and become more representative of the United States on the national stage. You know, I think a guy like, you know, like Buzio is age eligible. I think that could be, you know, but he's been with the national team, but he really has kind of fallen behind a lot of the midfield pecking order. And he's really on the bubble for Qatar. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't make it, like, you could say, well, the Olympics could be like a real good chance for him to reset, you know, and he's, because he's still a young player, and then kind of be ready to take that next role within the U.S. national team. You know, in terms of guys who, you know, aren't capped or have only been capped in like smaller friendlies, like John Tolkien for left back for the New York Red Bulls. I think he's a very exciting left back. I think he's a guy who could compete for that backup left back spot behind Anthony Robinson. And, you know, he's a guy I think, you know, could make the move to Europe sooner than later. And I think, you know, getting him involved with would be very interesting. You know, he's also, George Bell is also age eligible, but I mean, I think Tolkien might compete very well against him. You know, cause George had a tough defensively. It was kind of up and down with Atlanta, and then he got over to the Bundesliga and it really, you know, his defensive marking was kind of all over the place. So there's a lot of those kind of players too, like Tanner Tessman. I think is good. Cole Bassett is the one I really want to see with the Olympic team, because I think, you know, he's with Feyenoord now. And I think if he starts getting some minutes with Feyenoord this season, which is, I think, what they hope will happen with him, you know, he looks like he could kind of fit in that midfield box, you know, where, I mean, I don't know who the defensive midfield, maybe Aiden Morris for Columbus Crew. There's all these guys who really you didn't think about because they missed the exposure of their U20 cycle, but they could be there. You know, this kind of gives them a chance. And some of these current U20 guys will then supplement that talent, the talent from the older age group. But yeah, I really think it's going to be Ben Bender is another one I think is really interesting too. If you've been following Charlotte, like he's been, you know, he's the rookie this year. He's the number one overall draft pick, but you know, which doesn't really, it's not as important as it used to be, but you know, he's kind of a reminder, like him and Daryl DK, that really good talent can come out of college still at the highest of levels if they find a good environment to really begin their pro career. And Bender's found that. So yeah, I mean, there's some really good players there. Looking forward to making a list for an article about players who are really the most to benefit from this of that age group, who are most to benefit from the USU 20s getting across the finish line and qualifying for the Olympics.
So we have the Olympics, we have the U20 World Cup in May of 2023. Before that, we have an actual World Cup in the winter/November of 2022. Looking ahead to that, I want to talk about a few senior U.S. players who have moved or are likely to move and get your thoughts, because you have talked about many of these players. Some of them we've talked about for years now, but I want to start with Tyler Adams, and I'm going to ask you the question, then I'm going to explain where it's coming from so you don't get a whole bunch of preamble to a very basic question. The basic question is, how are you feeling about this move? The reason why I ask is because I feel sort of strangely sad about this transfer, and it doesn't really make any sense. It's not like I think it's a bad move. It's not like Leipzig was where I saw him for forever. I don't have any rooting interest in Leipzig. It's just that traditionally, or at least in the past few years, when Leipzig sell a player on, it's sort of Bayern Munich coming in and signing them for a ton of money. It's big clubs coming in and poaching these very big talents. And with Adams, it seems more like he wasn't really in the plans anymore. He wasn't going to get a ton of opportunities this season. And so, like, maybe if things broke a certain way, but otherwise he was going to be on the bench. And so in the end, it feels like a player who didn't quite fit the system being moved on. And that's not what I expected, I think, when Tyler Adams inevitably moved on for Leipzig. So it feels disappointing, even if it were like maybe 20 million more and Leipzig fought to keep him and he still went to Leeds, I would feel way better. It's just that sort of weirdness of the leaving. With all that rambling, I turn it over to you for your thoughts.
I mean, like, I think Tyler playing for Jesse is going to be a good thing. It's going to be so different for him, isn't it? Because, you know, when he was on the Red Bulls in New York, they were one of the best teams in the league, them and Atlanta. And so he was always, and then when he got to Leipzig, they were again a top five team in the Bundesliga. Now he's going to a team that narrowly escaped relegation. So how is he going to really, I think the defensive responsibilities that he's naturally so comfortable for are going to be a good thing. I think he covers the ground at a real elite level. And he's got a manager who knows exactly how to use him too. And a manager now that where he's erased a lot of his doubt. When Jesse was new at Leipzig from Salzburg, there was still a lot of doubt about him. He was American. I know he did well in Austria, but you know, Salzburg, you can also say, is sometimes on autopilot in Austria. But then, like, so now he went to Leeds and they did well. You know, he replaced Bielsa well. And people are really going to be inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt. And look, I think Tyler, I think he's going to do well. I'm actually optimistic about this thing. Yeah, you always want to write a positive end to every chapter, but that's not always the case, is it?
Not so much. How much pressure then do you think will be on Jesse Marsh? Because I think there is that the whole like, oh, he's an American, he's brought in two Americans, it's this American team. Do you think that's a sort of a stick with which they'll beat him throughout the season? Do you think that will subside? My assumption is that it will continue to be a talking point if Leeds don't start strongly.
Yeah, look, if they do well, it's going to be like, wow, he knows how to identify the right Americans. Because people right now see Americans going overseas and doing well. They just want to make sure that they're the right Americans. Mm-hmm. They're not just like, if Weston McKennie was heading over to Leeds, they'd all be ecstatic because he's been a regular starter with Juventus. So yeah, look, I think he does need to start well. But I think, I think what Leeds fans are looking for is not the pressure to win every game, but they're looking for some kind of a stabilization. And I think that they got it. I mean, I think that it'll be, I think that they'll do okay now that he has the chance to really work with them in preseason. He didn't have that advantage last season, but yeah, I mean, there is always going to be pressure on a manager when he starts bringing in players who he knows and has some kind of a relationship with for them to work. Otherwise, it's going to reflect poorly. So there's no denying it. No erasing it. But in the venture of the day, unlike Brendan, though, they tried to bring in Brendan
right
before Jesse was hired. So, there's less pressure there. I think most people know that because that was such a widely publicized attempted move by Leeds. But with Tyler, it goes back to the Red Bulls, too. That's well documented. So, yeah, there's pressure, but I kind of like it. I would put faith in Tyler to respond well.
But if Jesse Marsh is suddenly in for like John Tolkien, is that maybe one Red Bull, one American too far?
Yeah, that would be definitely, or Aaron Long or one of the guys he coached too long ago. But yeah, but obviously there's also a value to it too. I mean, if they get John Tolkien for like $800,000,
true.
I think most people would say like, okay, they got a good lottery ticket there. Although I think he's better than that. I like Tolkien, but like, you know what I'm saying? But if they go pay like $10 million for him, it's a horrible deal. So it comes down to the price.
So Tyler Adams, I believe, as we're recording, is doing his medical, finalizing his move. Maybe it's been finalized by the time people hear this. Jordan Pefok has also completed his move to Union Berlin. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. I want to ask your thoughts on that move, Brian. But I first wanted to talk to you about Pefok in general, because we've had you on the show many times over the years. One episode was inspired by then Jordan Theosin Sibachu announcing that he was willing to play for the United States. I think you talked to him or his representatives pretty early in that process or right around that time period. Are you surprised by how things have played out since then? I know you try to kind of keep calm about dual nationals playing for the U.S., but this is one that's sort of been up and down, ebbing and flowing throughout the years.
Yeah, it's good when you open up doors to all players wanting to play for the U.S. You just, and it hasn't been the case because the U.S. hasn't had a number nine. You want to uncover all stones. It's just sometimes you don't want to give preferential treatment towards a guy just because he might walk otherwise. Yeah. That's always the scare. And sometimes you're tempted to do that. I mean, I think with Jordan, he's a good player for, being inside that close range finishing. The worrisome is he going to help the team if he's not scoring? I don't know the answer to that yet because it is sometimes he could be completely invisible unless he's getting that service, whereas some other players, they can still make plays happen. They can open up the game for the wingers. They can play well with all the rest of the team. I mean, Jordan's just a straight up finisher. I think with this move to Union Berlin is going to be interesting because he had two moves inside France. He was did very well at Ligue 2. When he was moved up to Ligue 1, it didn't really work out well at all for either Rennes or Stade Reims, and then it worked out well again in Switzerland. So now now he's in his mid-20s. He's not a young player anymore. I think this first season is really going to tell us: is he a guy who can succeed within those big five leagues in Europe, or is he a guy that just excels when the level of play is drop down just a little bit in Switzerland or League Two? I mean, we don't know the answer to that. And this is going to be his third attempt now, third different team within a big five league, two in Ligue 1 and now one in the Bundesliga. So we're going to kind of really find out what kind of player he is. I don't think he'll get a fourth attempt if he doesn't, if he bombs out of Union Berlin. I don't think that'll just send too many red flags for a big five league. So it's going to be really revealing, particularly in this first season. They're going to want to strike while the lightning's hot, while he had a lot of momentum coming from a Champions League appearances where he scored a couple goals, and including qualifying, and then as well as in the Swiss Super League. But, the Swiss Super League sometimes produces really good players. Sometimes they have players who just do well just in those level of leagues. So we don't know.
looking at this purely from a U.S. MNT perspective in the lead up to Qatar, like, would you rather, if you had to choose, would you rather see Jordan Pefok like scoring goals pretty regularly for Union Berlin, but if they're like sort of like tap ins, headers from inside 12 yards, would you rather see him scoring fewer goals? But then like contributing in terms of dropping in and linking up play. And as you said, basically helping if he isn't scoring. Would you rather him just score goals, but maybe not develop, or develop, but maybe not score?
It's going to be controversial to say, but yeah, I think, you know, I'd rather have him helping out, like allowing guys like Gio Reyna and Christian Pulisic and those kind of players, Brendan Aaronson, be able to play their game. I mean, you know, the U.S., regardless of how well, Cibiche is never going to be the best player on the U.S. American player in the tournament. So the best thing you could do is make the best players play well. You know, and if you can make Christian Pulisic's life easier, or if you can make Gio Reyna or whoever's life, even if it's not like one of your best players, but you can open up the door for him because he's making a good run into the box and hit him in a well-timed move. You want him to be able to do that. So, yeah, I mean, although, look, if he's scoring tap-ins, that means the U.S. team is scoring.
Yeah,
so
true.
I understand the conflict there. But, you know, you don't want to have the U.S. to be playing with 10 players on the field just in hope only with 11 players when they get the ball into the opposing team's six. I don't think that that's going to really help the U.S. team very much.
A lot of what you said about Pefok seems to apply to Haji Wright as well. He's been heavily linked with Hull City. It seems like that move died on the vine. Now hearing rumors of Galatasaray and Trabzonspor. Is there a place you would like him to go? Would you like him to go to one of those big five leagues or anywhere in particular? What do you think he needs to kind of develop to that next level?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, it was such a struggle for Haji in the Bundesliga and Schalke and... Then when he went to the Eredivisie, I mean, like for just a while, nothing was really going his way. You know, do I now all of a sudden think he's ready to go back and help a team like Schalke or that level because he's improved so much? You know, I don't know. I think there's a level of comfort he just has now in Turkey. And I kind of think that in Turkey, you know, like we saw with Tyler Boyd, right? There's, you know, if you do really well at Turkey, you're going to tend to move up the chain within Turkey. Especially with one of those lower levels, you'll move into one of those big Istanbul clubs or one of the top teams there. And, you know, and then it's up to you to take advantage of a shot. Now, Tyler Boyd didn't, you know, struggle with the Besiktas and it didn't work out. Now I don't even know what's going to happen to him next. But like with Haji, though, it's like, you know, if he gets that shot, it's going to be up to him. And that's really all you can ask for is a shot. And if they spend a lot of money for him, he's going to get it. So I kind of think that there's going to be less red flags with him in Turkey because they're not going to be concerned about anything that he did in the Eredivisie or the Bundesliga. They're going to be looking at what he did, you know, within the Super League. And I think that that's going to give him a longer leash, which he may need. And then look, if he doesn't take advantage of it, you know, he could be the next Tyler Boyd. But, you know, I think in terms of getting that shot, I think it's going to be within Turkey.
While I pause to think about a future in which a person could be the next Tyler Boyd, we're going to take one more break and then we'll be back with a few more Americans who could be on the move or have already moved. We are back. Final segment for us. Brian, a couple more questions for you. Starting in goal, which American goalkeeper do you feel is in the best position or will be in the best position heading into the World Cup? We've got Ethan Horvath now on loan at Luton Town from Nottingham Forest, so no Premier League for him. Matt Turner at Arsenal, where he, I guess, will be in the Premier League, but we don't know how much he'll be playing. Zach Steffen reportedly going on loan. Middlesbrough, the team most heavily linked. Of those three, who do you think is in the best position?
Kind of thinking Matt Turner right now.
That feels safe.
Yeah, I mean, look, you could say, okay, he's not going to be starting for Arsenal, but at least you could say he might get some time in preseason, and then when the season starts around in August, you got about 2 months till the World Cup starts. I mean, he's still only 2 months away from being a starting goalkeeper. I mean, you know, Zach Steffen hasn't really been a regular starter, been in a consistent rhythm of games since his first only one half of the season at Ingolstadt. So, you know, yes, he could go to Middlesbrough. Yes, he could, he can play well there. Maybe, maybe not. There's always a little bit of a gamble there too. But I just think Turner just, you know, he's just going to be in such a regular, he's still not outside of being a bench warmer yet where it's a problem. So I just think the team is just going to be comfortable around him, particularly having played some games this summer with them too. Zach, you know, and the other question too is Zach's injuries. You know, he's missed a lot of time with knees and backs, and you know, it's been tough for him to stay healthy. Ethan, I just think the problem is even if he goes and starts at Luton Town, what kind of does the U.S. team have the confidence around him to be a regular starter for the full national team going into the World Cup, especially at a point when he's never been the U.S. team's number one before, then all of a sudden being the number one, all of a sudden at the World Cup, now he's the number one. Like, I just don't think it's going to work that way for him. I think he's going to have to hope that maybe the next cycle is a little bit better for him.
That's a really good point. Also, I'm realizing that Matt Turner playing at Arsenal, the kind of common deficiency identified in his game would be distribution. At Arsenal, we would assume he'll get many more opportunities to improve that distribution, whereas Stefan Horvath, I don't know if Luton and Middlesbrough respectively do a ton of building out of the back. I'm assuming they do some, but I don't know how much footwork they're going to get. So yeah, I think Matt Turner to Arsenal, probably the safest bet there. That's goalkeeper. Let's talk center backs. Let's go on a happier one first. Chris Richards, rumored to be moving to Spain, England, and France. It's going to be difficult for him to be playing in those three countries and Germany, where he's also linked. So could be difficult playing for 12 clubs in four countries all at the same time. If that is not feasible, where do you feel most comfortable with him ending up? Either which league or which of the teams he's been linked with do you think would be best for him?
You know, I think just anywhere in the Bundesliga would be the best place. Mm-hmm. If it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, Hoffenheim was a great spot for him. You know, it was just because the coach knew him from Bayern, and obviously you have to look at, okay, if he's not good enough for Bayern Munich, I mean, then he's not going to be going to an elite club anyway. So, cause Bayern would want to keep him if he was that good. So Hoffenheim was just outside that level, and it was the perfect level for someone going on loan from Bayern. I don't like to give too much leeway into rumors. I think anywhere that where he plays and plays regularly is just a good spot for him. I mean, whether they was linked to Crystal Palace, but again, like that, you know, I think anywhere in the Premier League, he's going to be looking at as like a number three central defender. So I think there's probably going to be more possibilities in the other European leagues. But he's a good player, one that I think could start at the World Cup.
If Richards goes somewhere other than Hoffenheim, could that open the door for John Brooks to then move in there?
It could. It could, certainly. I mean, there's been teams from France linked with him. There's been teams all over looking for John. Look, I mean, he's still his form goes up and down. And the thing with John is he runs into conflicts with his managers wherever he goes eventually over time. But a smooth, tall, left-footed pass, smooth passing, left-footed central defender with his level of experience is always going to have doors open to him for a long period of time too. But yeah, I mean, Hoffenheim, I could see that level being just the perfect fit for him. Whether that puts him on back in the national team remains to be seen.
You said that very like matter-of-factly. I want to talk a little bit more about that for a moment. He has conflicts with his managers wherever he goes.
Yeah.
What do you have any ideas as to what those might be about? Is it him wanting more playing time? Is it him disagreeing with their philosophy?
Look at having a Wolfsburg, right? I mean, there's some things that looked poorly on Wolfsburg. I mean, there was negative reports in Bild. Literally I think there's two different reports within a span of 2 or 3 weeks over the winter breaks, if you remember those things. And those were definitely had to come from within the club. They were pretty much airing dirty laundry. And then within a couple weeks later, it was announced he wasn't going to be returning to the club anymore. And I don't think it was the coach, because the coach continued to play him. I think that was all front office stuff, just not happy with how negotiations went. But again, you know, it's been tough. I mean, look, there's been some things that John did that were just stupid. Like for example, remember when, I don't know if he was at Hertha at the time, or I think he was still at Hertha at the time, when he got a giant back tattoo and he was too sore to play in a Bundesliga game. Like, he got it like 2 days before. He forgot. And then the manager really got angry at him. Like, that was tough. And then Jurgen Klinsmann's last couple of games at the start of the last World Cup qualifying cycle didn't go well either. I mean, you know, he lost his marker on the game to again against Mexico. Jurgen Klinsmann was the first to single him out in that press conference. I was there. So, you know, and I don't know if there was anything that led Jurgen to do that too, but so things kind of with John were with Brooks have been really up and down with his man. And there's been other things too. Like, if you notice, he's been in and out of the starting lineup. They try to bring him in to be replaced when they brought in, I forget, the Red Bull Salzburg's central defender at Wolfsburg 2 seasons ago, when they brought him in as a hoping to move Brooks to the bench. Brooks got in because the other guy got a red card, and then Brooks started playing the best soccer of his career there for about 4 or 5 weeks. But there was an effort to replace him in the starting 11 at Wolfsburg too. So, you know, but if you ever notice too, is like when his back's up against the wall, when he gets angry, when he gets threatened with the club situation, when he does something stupid, he tends to respond with like really terrific soccer. He's an interesting guy to motivate, and one that really requires a lot of coaching and a lot of aggravation, but there is a good defender in there somewhere. But you observe him over the years, it's really something to behold.
Do you feel like that all informs why he hasn't been selected by Greg Berhalter of late? I'm assuming it's sort of an accumulation of things on and off the pitch.
I have absolutely nothing to back this up. This is just a wild hunch on my part. But like, it wouldn't surprise me if they're just if they realize that to get John Brooks playing well, you need to make him mad, you know, and maybe if they do eventually bring him back into the team, like, he's mad and he starts playing great soccer. But like, I think, you know, there's a sense of complacency with his career. When he's complacent, he performs poorly. And when he gets mad or he gets in trouble, runs into it, that he starts playing well. I thought he played well at the end of the last season. But remember, he was also announced that negotiations had broken down with Wolfsburg to bring him back. And there was also those negative reports that came that looked like the sources came from within inside the club, so which probably made him mad. So a mad Brooks is the best John Brooks, you know, and that's just always been my theory on it. And I don't know if other people see it, too. And they're just trying to make him mad to bring him in. To get the best out of him.
Do you think we're ever going to get a full moment of clarity on this one? Like, John Brooks made fun of Greg Berhalter's sneakers one too many times. Do you think we'll ever get that level of detail, or do you think they're going to keep it vague if he's called in and if he's not called in again?
Sometimes these things pop to the surface, too, long after the point when people really start to care about it. But, like, you know, if you go back and, you know, it won't have the level of hype that people still talk about John Harkes and Eric Winalda and all those shenanigans. That was like, that's still legendary stuff. Like, but then there's certain things that come out after the time when like no one really cares. If the team does well in France, not France. I was kind of had a 1998 flashback. If the team does well in Qatar, with or without Brooks, I don't think anyone's going to look too hard about the reason behind. There's always one player out there that has a tough time fitting in with the team, with the manager, and there's always alternative ways to try to get the most out of them. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading the book about what happened to John Brooks someday at some point. But in the meantime, a couple more players. Gianluca Busio, we've talked about previously, seems destined to go out on loan, given that he has that clause in his contract with Venezia. If they get relegated, he can go out on a loan automatically. Have you heard any parties that are specifically interested in Gianluca Busio?
No, I mean, like, I've heard him linked outside of Italy. It would probably, you know, his Italian passport helps. Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he's like joins one of the many Americans in Belgium. You know, for tax purposes, it makes it easier for him to be loaned out within Italy. But again, it comes down to what kind of takers there are too. You know, he's a player that needs some work defensively and physically to fit into Serie A. You know, and you know, those players are machines in the midfield defensively and with their motor and how much ground they can cover. So he has to show that. But whether or not he's going to have any takers in Serie A remains tough because his only European experience is within Serie A. I kind of think he's going to go outside of Serie A, probably to a Belgium or Eredivisie team. But then it comes down to how much of the salary is Venezia gonna cover. Even with the reduction, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of teams in those leagues don't have the ability to cover a lot of salary. For example, we talked about Haji right earlier. When they sold him to, I think it was VV Venlo, like, you know, Schalke was still eating the salary for Haji so that they could send him there. He could get playing time and be, remember, he had to get paid the non-EU minimum, which is high in Holland. But to get that, like, Schalke was still fitting the bill. So it's going to have to be something like that. There's going to be all kinds of, you know, wage structuring is going to be tough for him too. So he's going to have limited options if he wants to make a lot of money. But I think it'll still be in, I think still, you know, I would go out on a limb and say Belgium.
And it does seem like he will go out on loan. But if he didn't, I am not particularly familiar with Serie B. I don't know if you are.
Oh, it's tough. Yeah, I am. I'm Italian. It's, you know, it's the, even the lower part of Serie A can be tough. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, facilities, you know, the modes of transportation getting around the country, the budgets go way down in Serie B. You know, and even then, like, they wanted this key stay in Serie A, Venezia did, and have all kinds of upgrades to that stadium on the island, the Penso. And those are not just going to, and that's still, that's a really, I mean, there's high school stadiums in this country that are nicer than the Penso. And it's for a Serie B team, now all of a sudden you don't even have the Juventuses and the AC Milans coming in, but they're smaller clubs. The budgets are really not there. And then you're going to small little community stadiums. Serie B is not a glamorous life. You know, you're itching just to get out. It's not like the championship where there's some big known teams there. There's still, you still get some games on international television. You know, life in Serie B can be tough, but it's not a bad place to learn if you're willing to do it. But if Buzio has other options, I'm sure he's probably thinking of a little bit more, you know, comfortable options as well.
One more midfielder from the current U.S. team I wanted to get your thoughts on. And then I have a larger, broader question for you. But Luca Della Torre is one who, I guess, if you asked me, I would have thought he'd played for a couple different or a few different clubs, I should say, not a couple. But because he's been on the radar for so long, but looking at it again, he moves to Fulham in 2013 in the academy system. He's there until 2020. Now he's been with Heracles since then, and now he's looking for a new team. What do you think puts him in the best position heading into Qatar? My assumption is somewhere still in the Netherlands, ideally for a better team, a little bit more possession-based team, where he is still starting pretty regularly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think his saving grace is he's played well for the U.S. national team. Mm-hmm. And he's within that picture. That's a big help to his resume, because other than that, you know, you have to see Luca Della Torre play to know his qualities. Mm-hmm. Because if you're just looking at a stat sheet and you're looking out to, and you're some scout in Europe for a team in Germany or a team in Italy or wherever, and you're gonna say, okay, there's a starting midfielder for a team that got relegated in the Eredivisie, and he had one goal and one assist all season and played about 3,000 minutes, which is a lot. And he, like I said, he only had, and the team got relegated under him, and they only had one goal, one assist. Most people are going to say, like, that's not a player we're interested in, or if we are interested in it, it's a backup option. But I think the teams that know his quality and know that he brings something more to the table are probably going to be Dutch teams that have seen him play regularly. It's going to take a lot of homework to realize he's good. You know, but the U.S. team, kind of playing with the U.S. team, allows him to do more homework. So maybe it opens the door to a bigger team outside of the Eredivisie in another place. But yeah, you're right. I do think you just don't want him to become a luxury player that a rich team can afford. And they see him as a situational guy. You want to have a guy who can compete and start. You know, I don't think it's going to be Ajax or PSV, or, you know, Feyenoord. Those are the big three there, you know, Aze, they've been pretty good lately. You know, he's going to have to work his way up. I just think the really thing that kills me about him in his career is that I think he stayed at Fulham way too long. I mean, cause he's now 24. That's not old, but it's not young either. And his only success is at Heracles, and then the bench of the day they went down. So, yeah, I still think he's going to stay within. I don't think he's never going to go back to England. I just don't see that. That was not a good experience for him. But I still think the Dutch teams are going to be more inclined to know his qualities as opposed to someplace else.
From what you know of Luca De La Torre, or from what you've seen or heard from him, if you've interviewed him previously, like, he definitely seems to have a bit of that feistiness to him. There were the jokes about him being like the enforcer for this team. Is there a multiverse in which Luca De La Torre is playing for Atletico Madrid under Diego Simeone and doing well? Obviously, he's not at that level now, but I think about a manager who would sort of reward that feistiness, that competitiveness, but also prioritize technical ability.
Oh, they love that. I mean, you know, if you can be out there and be feisty and stuff like that, and I mean, it rallies your team. Players want to play with players like that, you know, and it's a guy that players want on the team and they want on the field. Then when you're on the field, you won half the battle because then they want to keep you on the field. You know, I think in terms of how much higher his up ceiling is going to be, you know, how much more like a really kind of technical number eight kind of a player improves after 24. You know, there's debate about that. There's certainly some people who have improved after that age. But, you know, I don't think it's as common as what would make you feel like there's a huge, huge upside for Luca. I think he's got one more big move left in him after this upcoming move. So, you know, I think he's got to get it right. But, yeah, you know, his feistiness is a good thing. I mean, particularly in the international game where the game can be a little bit more raw because players are not with each other as often as they would like. So it's not, you know, you can't really have a complex system. It's really, you know, that's why individualism tends to, you know, shine through the most. And he's got a lot of that, you know, and it can be feisty and stuff. I think he's a guy who clearly belongs in the U.S. team and the U.S. pitcher, but yeah, just at the club level, it's just not it. That relegation just really, really, really hurt. I think it came at the worst possible time for him too.
Final line of questioning for you. We've talked a bunch about players who either have moved this summer or could move this summer. I wanted to ask about players who moved in January. Your Ricardo Pepis, your Kevin Paredes's. I'm sure many other names that you would like to talk about, Brian, but who are the names that, like, sort of you, as we're getting closer to the start of preseason, the start of the regular season, that you are most excited to see get that full preseason and get a new season started? Who do you think is poised for, hopefully, some success?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Ricardo's still going to get chances regardless. I think that's the obvious answer, and we don't have to go into why. I mean, $20 million deal to Augsburg, you know, and the U.S. needing a number nine. The story kind of writes itself. It's not talked about a lot, but I'm really interested in Cole Bassett because, you know, he's at a really good Dutch club. He did well for Colorado. You know, position-wise, it was kind of, was he a number 10? Was he, you know, second striker? He played a lot of different positions. But I'm kind of curious to see if he can make that jump. You know, I think it was all about getting him slowly involved with the team. But, you know, an 18-month loan is going to give him, I think, really set the stage for him just getting gradually introduced last season. And this is now about him taking the next steps. Yeah, you know, Kevin Paredes is obvious too. I mean, he's a winger. He's explosive. I always like Kevin because he can win his duels. His defense is outstanding too. In addition to his offense, positional wise, I don't think that gets talked about enough. And his feistiness, we were just talking about it with Luca. You know, Paredes has that in droves too. You know, there's a lot of guys who moved in January. You know, Justin Che and but yeah, I think Bassett and Paredes are guys. That really should be, you know, I'm really intrigued because they didn't really get a lot of time, but they're guys they went over there, you know, with some momentum at their back, and particularly with Paredes, they spent real money on him too. And I like that because it shows that the team's fully invested in them and they're not going to let him go unless they've given every single last ounce of opportunity for the player to make a case for himself.
Which jump do you think is stranger, for Kevin Paredes to go from Loudoun United to DC to Wolfsburg, or for Cole Bassett to go from the Colorado Springs Switchbacks to Colorado Rapids to Feyenoord?
Well, I mean, the more impressive one was Paredes because it was a full transfer. You know, I mean, they went and spent $7 or $8 million for him. You know, I mean, Cole is interesting because he's, you know, it's an 18-month loan, so it's wait and see. Still, they have to pay him a lot of money because there's that Eredivisie minimum salary. that really is high by design. That makes it also only the best non-EUs really sneak their way into that league. So they both have some interesting things about it too, but Paredes was definitely the eye catcher, because even for Wolfsburg, which has more resources, being a Bundesliga team, they spent a lot of money for him too. Whereas, he's still in the shop window, whereas Bassett's still in the shop window at Feyenoord.
Well, Brian Ciretta, thank you for being so generous with your time and talking about many, many, many different Americans. If people would love to read more from you, how can they do so?
Sure. American Soccer Now is a home base for me. I'm over at Soccer America a lot too, and you can find out where I'm going to be on Twitter too. So, Brian Ciretta, you'll find me engaging with people and putting out my thoughts and everything. So, been at this for a long time. So hope I can offer stuff.
Yeah,
so, hope to keep going.
Thank you, Brian, for all your time. Listeners, thank you for joining us today. We very much appreciate it, and we will talk to you again very soon.